Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Today, my guest is Rachel O'Brien. She's a popular stand-up comedian and actress and host of the true crime investigative podcast, Seven Deadly Sinners. She is often boots on the ground when conducting in-person investigations into cults, church scandals, and even political murders. She began her career as a touring stand-up comic, sharing the stage with the likes of Judge Apatow, Dave Spade and Whitney Cummings. She performed in seven countries and has performed overseas for the troops. Welcome to the Nick Bryan podcast, Rachel.
Thank you for having me. It's very embarrassing to have your bio read to you.
I always prefer short bios. I always send a short bio. I get a little self-conscious when someone reads a long bio, but yours is nice and kind of gets across the point.
Yeah, we got to the point. Did a good job reading it.
And Rachel is coming to us from Colorado.
Yes.
And I'm coming to you from New York City. That's not really my background. But if I was going to show you my background, you would see a brick wall. But since I live in New York City and it's so expensive and it's noisy and dirty, it might as well look like I have a cool background. I mean, that's always been my rationale.
Oh, well, wouldn't say that my background's cool. I don't know how to do those like fake ones because currently I have to live at my father-in-law's house. That's why I'm like angled so you can't see the decor. We're building a big container home ourselves and it's just not done yet. And I would normally have my own decor. My father-in-law who lives in Indianapolis has never ranched a day in his life, but this is his like ranch house in Colorado. Has really taken on, there's lots of taxidermy in here and other things that just wouldn't really be my thing. I mean, he has like there's a deer's butt that's carved into the face of like a person and he named it Portia to torture me.
So how is your relationship with your father-in-law?
Oh, I absolutely love him. He's hilarious. Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. And I will literally tell him, like, we were once at a store somewhere in Colorado, Gunnison or something. And he was like, should I get this stuffed raccoon? I was like, no, Mike, absolutely not. You are not doing that. That is ugly and tacky.
When I was in college, I lived in an apartment and I inherited the number of a taxidermy place.
Really?
So people would call me up and ask me to like taxidermy fish and things like that. And I said, we only do humans here. And and then at that point they said, well, you know, that sounds kind of illegal or weird or whatever. I said, well, you know, I mean, we've changed our,
our business.
Yeah. And but I always had to deal with those at least once or twice a week.
That's hilarious.
How did I find out about Rachel? I was talking to my friend Alicia Owen a few weeks back, and she said I should check out Rachel's podcast, Seven Deadly Sinners, because it had a number of episodes about the Franklin scandal. I've always been reluctant to check out stuff about the Franklin scandal because for some inexplicable reason, the Illuminati and shape-shifting reptilians get woven into the story. But Alicia assured me that Rachel's rendition of Franklin was accurate, and there wasn't any shape-shifting reptilians. And I thought, that's a novelty. And then Alicia said that Rachel actually gave me credit when using my material. And I said, that's a novelty. So I gave the episodes a listen and I was very, very impressed.
Thank you.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about your background in Seven Deadly Sinners?
So my background in Seven Deadly Sinners, it started, I wanted to start a true crime podcast. I'd been doing like a comedy interview one for a while. And I think that the day that I got pitched, because I would interview, like, I interviewed some amazing people like Winnie McLennan Covey from Reno 911 and Bridesmaids. And she was wonderful. I interviewed so many amazing people. Then I started getting pitched like a blogger who got famous because she lost 3 pounds and something. And I was just like, I don't care anymore. Like, I just don't care. And so I wanted to start a true crime podcast, but I kind of knew that I would be all over the map. So I originally started with like just doing televangelists that had committed crimes. Like I did like Warren Jeffs isn't necessarily a televangelist, but like I did Warren Jeffs. I did Robert Tilton, who, I mean, he might be a bad dude, but by God, is he hilarious. Just the shit he can pull. Because I felt like I needed to narrow it down. But then I started to just sort of branch out into any kind of like Seven Deadly Sin and became obsessed with the Franklin scandal. Like, I truly thought, I don't know, I was going to connect the I don't know. I just became obsessed with it. I probably read / listened, because I had it on Kindle and Audible, your book at least twice, maybe more than that. And yeah, I became obsessed with like thinking I was gonna like link it to something like the Children of the Snow type thing and the that we talked about.
It's interesting. You started investigating churches first. I've always thought that they were kind of interesting. I once met the televangelist Jim Baker. And I met him at
I covered him.
You covered him? I met him in a federal prison. I wasn't incarcerated there, but he was.
Oh.
I was visiting a friend of mine who had been an
Did you interview him?
No, I was visiting a friend of mine who had been an Herbal Life distributor, aka marijuana, and he got busted by the feds for marijuana, so he got like 5 years for a nonviolent drug offense. And I was visiting him, and Jim Baker had gotten like a 100-year sentence or 150 years, and Tammy had gotten nothing. And how this worked is they took you, you were in a group, and then they guards would escort you through a courtyard, and then you go into the visiting room. And I was with Tammy Faye, and you know, she put on her makeup with like a trowel, and I saw Jim, and he had this malignant smirk on his face, and there was something very sinister about him. And
really,
if you wanted to use the bathroom at this place, you had to go up front and get the key from one of the guards, and then you'd go to the bathroom. And so I saw her walk by me and get the key and walk to the bathroom. And the only thing that really came up to my mind through my mind was, wow, she's very, very damaged. And Jim had this smirk, but Jim was fond of performing favors for the people at the prison, the prisoners at the prison. He was very fond of it. And he was actually noted for
it. Are you saying like sexual?
Sexual, yes. And what amazes me is the dude has another evangelical show now. After all that.
He's selling like buckets of slop. Yeah, I covered all of that on the, and he tells you when he's pitching the like on his whatever like QVC type thingy or whatever. He's like, the great thing about it, because it's like end of days type stuff, he's like, is you can put a bunch of them together, put a nice piece of cloth over it, and then it's a coffee table. I'm like, you're insane, sir.
Well,
you're absolutely insane.
But the gall of him, especially after his performance in prison. I mean, he was quite noted, as I said. And to have another evangelical show, it just amazes me.
This guy has absolutely no shame.
He's a sociopath, as we find out, have no shame.
Yep.
And so you're reading the Franklin scandal and you think it's got to be hooked up to the Illuminati, or what did you think?
No, not the Illuminati. No, not at all. No, just the amount of kids that were going kind of missing during that time and being ignored, you know, as just runaways or, you know, I mean, I believe everything that you wrote in there. And I believe, I mean, everything I think that Paul Benassi said. I mean, I know that they tried to take him down by saying he had multiple personality disorder, and maybe he did from trauma.
He definitely did. But that did not preclude him from telling the truth, which is what the judiciary said.
Yeah, exactly. I want to know from you, I'm very curious about this, because you've lived such a huge life. I mean, even just your story about Jim Baker. But you still continue to pursue what a lot of people would not pursue. And you've been threatened. Very curious about like if you could tell, because we're kind of dual sharing stories or podcasts here, my listeners, about the time you were threatened when you went to go get the child sexual abuse material in Colorado, and then you've also been trailed in other places. Those stories to me are fascinating. It's fascinating to me that you don't stop. Like, that didn't scare you away from then covering Epstein. And
well, the truth is, I've always been a little suicidal.
You're like, if it's going to happen that way, fine. I'm not going to do it myself.
When I first got to Nebraska, I was pretty skeptical. I knew something had gone down. And I thought it was kind of confined to Nebraska. And I didn't really think that I'd find much. And actually, as I was telling you earlier, I lived on an ashram of a genuine Indian guru, and one of my buddies at that ashram had moved to Omaha, back to Omaha, and so I was going to visit him, and I thought we'd just have a nice week and a half visit and hang out. We hadn't hung out in a while, and then I told him what I was doing. We went out for dinner, and I told him what I was doing. He kind of looked at me like, you know, Nick, are you doing all right in life? I mean, and then, but then things started happening. The Nebraska State Patrol started calling his house every day. I went there in 2002. I didn't even have a cell phone at that point. And we were talking to someone who he knew who had been an Herbalife distributor. To that crew, that trafficking crew, and he had witnessed some very, very bad things, and he started actually crying, and he didn't want to talk to me. I'd talked to him about 3 years later, and then I was followed, and then the denouement was the woman coming up to the door and threatening my life. So that was how it played out, and it's kind of interesting. My buddy, he's a very good cook, and he bought a bunch of groceries, and we were going to have a nice meal that night. But, you know, he was there when she did that. So it kind of freaked him out. Actually, it kind of freaked me out. You know, we had a very nice dinner, but we didn't sleep well that night. So Rachel did a podcast series on the Franklin scandal. And tell us a little bit about that, how you got intrigued by it.
So I basically, I don't even know how I found it. I'm actually not quite sure how I even found it. But then I immediately downloaded your book, and I listened to it and/ read it on Kindle, I would say at least 2 to 3 times, and kind of became obsessed with it.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
So I became obsessed with it. And like you, and you stated in your book, you did not want to believe that it was true. Like, you really tried to, like, debunk it of sorts. And I felt the same way. Like, this can't be true. But at every turn when I was reading your book, and then I would go do my own, like, side research and stuff, like, yeah, like, no, my wish to not believe it to be true ended up not happening, because I believe it to be true. And I find you so fascinating that you wanted to not believe it to be true, but you looked into it and then were threatened multiple times, but you still keep going and doing, like, covering Epstein and, you know, the Diddy case and everything. It's like you're undeterred from uncovering the truth.
Well, you know, I've got this, I think it's a strange notion amongst my fellow Americans. I just don't think children should be trafficked with impunity. I mean, I'm really down with that. And yeah. I don't necessarily think that, I think most, that more Americans would be down with that if they really understood Epstein or Franklin. But cognitive dissonance and denial are very powerful psychological mechanisms.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. So can you tell me a few of the stories in which you were threatened, like the one in Omaha and then the one in Colorado, or pulled over, I guess?
The one in Omaha with, there was a woman. So I'd been in Omaha for about 8 or 9 days, and I'd kind of concluded that it was all real. I talked to Paul Benassi, Rusty Nelson, and some other people. And then what got to me in Omaha was people were frightened to talk about this, were frightened. And I tried to make myself a lightning rod. I was very vociferous about being there. And call a lot of people, because I just didn't, initially I was skeptical, but, you know, I studied philosophy in college, and I was taught to approach everything agnostically, and I really try very hard to do that, but this was kind of a little over the top. So I was skeptical, but then things started happening. My friends, started getting a call from the Nebraska State Patrol every day, and I never gave them my number. And then I was shocked. But what really got me was people were so frightened. It was like I was doing an expose on the KGB and Stalinist Russia. I mean, that's what I felt like. And and then the last night I was watching the History Channel. I'd had kind of a tough week in Omaha, coming across this transcontinental pedophile network that was hooked up to intelligence and blackmailed people and plundered Boys Town. The whole thing was, you know, pretty shocking to me. And then a woman came to the door, and she was kind of a freaky looking woman. And she said that she had a book for me. Now, at this point, I was really, not only was I freaked out, but I did not want her fingerprints in my buddy's apartment. And I did not want my fingerprints on that book, because at that point, I just I wanted to be safe than sorry. So I said, you know, just, you know, go on, please leave and, you know, have a good night. And she kept on pounding on the door. And I said, no, please just go away and leave. And then my buddy came back and he bumped into her in the lobby of the apartment building. And he did a double take because she was kind of freaky looking. And I said to him, did you see that woman? Because he arrived, I don't know, seconds after she left. And she goes, yeah. And he went, yeah, you know, she's kind of freaky looking. And I said, yeah, man, she's been trying to give me a book. And I just don't want her fingerprints in your apartment. I don't want us going down for something that could have been prevented. Because at this point, I was freaked out. And I knew that there'd been amazing judicial and law enforcement malfeasance to cover this up. So he started to cook dinner for us, very good cook. And then she came back and we huddled by the door. And I said, dude, you know, I just don't want my fingerprints or your fingerprints on her book. And I don't want her fingerprints in your apartment. I just think that that's the best way to go here. So I said, you got to go. And then she eventually left, but she said, you're in a grave danger and they're going to kill you. that was a wake up call. Although, you know, we had a very nice dinner. He cooked us a very nice dinner, but neither one of us slept that well that particular night. But the most frightened I was when Rusty Nelson and I were pulled over. That was definitely the most frightened. That's probably the most frightened I've ever been in my life, maybe. I'm not sure.
Can you give a little backstory on that? So Rusty was a convicted...
Rusty was a convicted child pornographer, and he was a blackmail. He was a blackmail photographer for the Franklin Network. And when you go into stories like this that are really dirty and unsavory, you're going to have to deal with dirty, unsavory people. Mm-hmm. And you're going to have to try to get as much truth out of them as you possibly can, as much truth as they're willing. Because people like this, they're not completely, I mean, they're capable of telling the truth, but they're incapable of making themselves look bad. So, but we got to the point where he was starting to tell me the truth and made some self-incriminating statements. But then, so he had been hassled by law enforcement and he had found a girlfriend and he'd moved in with her. And she had some money and she enabled him to open a photography studio. And he was, I mean, the dude is a good photographer. I got to give him that. He's a little unsavory and unctuous, but he's a very good photographer. And within a day of opening, the Nebraska State Patrol raided his photography studio, impounded all his computers, put him in jail, and shut his entire studio down. And he hadn't registered as a sex offender. So that was the rationale. And I told him that I would get him a lawyer if he gave me blackmail pictures, because he alluded to having blackmail pictures. I do believe that he gave blackmail pictures to Gary Carador in Chicago. Actually, I'm pretty certain that he did. I thought
and that's
that,
why Gary Carador was killed. Yeah. So for my listeners. Yeah.
Yeah. So with Rusty, so he took me to some places in the mountains and he put me on a wild goose chase. And I almost, you know, was climbing up this step, and it was like granite or rock steps, like 10 feet up. And because he told me that the pictures were stashed behind this waterfall. So I climbed up and I grabbed a hold of a branch and I took a really bad fall. I mean, I came flat down on my butt, 10 feet straight drop, And and then I made it up to the waterfall. And the waterfall, behind the waterfall, hadn't been probably disturbed since the Jurassic period. And that made me very angry because I'd taken this fall. So I marched him up the mountain behind the waterfall. And I, you know, said, look, there's nothing there. There's never been anything there. And I said, I'm going back to the car. I'm going to give you a ride back to Nebraska. So, but we'd been clandestine about doing this. And I had made a video before I left that I said I was going to go for blackmail pictures. So if something happened to me or if I got busted with those blackmail pictures, I had this backup video. That was the thing about Franklin. I think that to get as deep into it as I did, I had to be pretty smart at times to really cover myself. And so Rusty and I, we haven't really talked at all because my ass hurts and he's taken me on this wild goose chase. And I've already given some money to his attorney who will get no more money. And we're about 5 miles from his place on this desolate highway, two-way highway. It was, I was doing 70 and a 65 and I got pulled over. And
where was it again?
It was in,
you told me the other day, but...
it was in Nebraska in the sticks.
Oh, okay. You weren't pulled over in Colorado.
In Nebraska. And so,
but the pictures were allegedly stashed
in Nebraska. Yeah.
I thought they were.
So the cop pulled us over. And, you know, I look like an upstanding white boy. I really do. My hair is kind of short. I wear glasses. I mean, I look kind of like a professor. And he walked up to the car. I gave him my New York driver's license. And he said, come back. And he escorted me to the cruiser. I mean, immediately. He didn't even look at my driver's license, really. So at that point, I was in the squad car. And then he was talking to Rusty, which I didn't think was going to be an auspicious undertaking for either one of us. And then he called in Rusty. He called me in, and I was clean. And then he called in Rusty. And then the dispatcher said a lot of numbers that I knew weren't very good numbers. And then they took Rusty from the car, and now there's two of them, and they got a dog, and they took Rusty from the car. And but they're keeping us apart because they don't want us communicating. And then they ripped apart this rental car that I'd rented. And sitting in that cop car, I was frightened because I was with Rusty Nelson. I mean, a guy who's got a very unsavory past. And we are in the middle of nowhere, and these guys easily could have killed us. We're right next to a huge cornfield. I mean, so, or planted something on us. I mean, I was really, that's what I was worried about too, was them planting something on us. So that was the end of Rusty and me.
Yeah, I can imagine. How do you have the gumption though to keep, okay, so you're the one that exposed, you know, Epstein's little black book and all that. How do you still have the gumption after being that frightened to go up against, I don't know. Well, I know I wouldn't say that Epstein's arguably more powerful. No, I don't know. What would you say?
Say they're both serving the same masters. The Franklin pimps and then Epstein are serving the same, some rogue element of our intelligence.
Yeah.
And like I said, I have this strange notion that children shouldn't be abused with impunity, that the government shouldn't aid and abet child trafficking. And I had a difficult childhood. And when I came across Franklin, by the time I came across, I'd written a book about lower socioeconomic children in America. I'd written a ton of stuff about lower socioeconomic children in America. I didn't come to this as a conspiracy guy. I came to this as someone that cared about the welfare of children. Mm-hmm. And I really I still believe that. And I want to do whatever. I mean, when I left Nebraska, I kind of made a pact with myself that I'm going to go for this, and what's going to happen is going to happen. If I get killed, I get killed. I mean, that was kind of the pact I made with myself. Because when I got back, I was pretty freaked out. When I got back to New York City, my mentor, Jerry, he was a retired journalist, and we'd have breakfast every Saturday morning together. And but I called him and I said, Jerry, you know, I need some FaceTime. And we were walking through Washington Square Park, and I was looking for snipers on the roofs. So, I mean, I had been affected by this. And so we sat down, and he was such a great guy. I love him. He died about 12 years ago. I loved him as much as I could really love anybody. And he said to me, this is dangerous. I won't think anything less of you if you decide not to do this. And I said, Jerry, you know, I don't think I can go back now. I just don't think I can go back. I know that this is a reality. And if I didn't do my best to try to expose this, I just don't think I could live with myself. So that was that. I kept going.
Go ahead.
And there was some intimidation, but nothing. The first time I was there, I mean, it was like a full court press. And I think that they'd done that to a number of journalists that had gone there sniffing around Franklin, and then they gotten rid of them pretty easily. So, but I did do something that was kind of unique, because I kind of felt people were on my phone for sure. And I had my friends call me. And because I left Nebraska with a lot of documents and some pretty good interviews, and I had my friends call me, and they said, well, what happened in Nebraska? And I said, oh man, you know, it's just too dangerous. I'm not going to go back to Nebraska ever again, because I wanted to make sure that the people listening on my phone thought that I was sufficiently frightened to never go back to Nebraska again. And I think that there was some disengagement at that point. When I started going back to Nebraska with regularity, I think that kind of they changed their attitude, but they left me alone for a while. Mm-hmm. The weird phone call stopped.
What am I mixing up with Colorado and Nebraska now? And I'm confused, because I thought
Rusty had the pictures he said in Colorado. So I picked him up at his girlfriend.
So that's where you fell on your butt.
Yeah, that was a really bad fall. And So
the waterfall was in Colorado. Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And we were like 10,000 feet up. We were very high up. And
yeah. Gosh, I just want to know exactly where the area was. It just fascinates me. And I'm also guessing you said granite, but I know from when you're climbing up, because
it was hard rock. Yeah.
But did it break apart easily?
No, it was.
Okay, so it wasn't the sandstone that breaks apart. Okay.
No, it was. I fell. I have done climbing before, but mm-hmm. I was too transfixed on getting to that waterfall. Mm-hmm. And I got careless. I mean, that's basically the bottom line, is I got careless.
I don't understand, though, why a person like was that really a wild goose chase, or was the stuff just not there anymore? But like, how would he know or think, unless he was just crazy, that there was something stashed there?
Well, when you're dealing with these kinds of people, they have the potential to believe their own lies. That's
okay.
And I don't know what he thought. Like, I don't know if he thought, well, you know, I'm going to take him on this wild goose chase. I'm going to say, you know, his cover story was, well, they've already been there, you know, I mean, but like I said, behind that waterfall hadn't been touched since the Jurassic period. So no one had been there. And then that's, I got really upset. Actually, I started yelling at him. I'm not really a guy that yells too much, but I started yelling at him.
I mean, I get upset too, but I still believe Paul Benassi about the house. I went there. There is an elephant shaped rock at that house in Buena Vista. I mean, I literally drove there by myself. Like I believe it. I was just short of driving up to it. And then I was like, oh, there's a lot of no trespassing signs. I am by myself. This is unwise. But like visually seeing it, like there's no way he could describe that place if he hadn't have been there. There is that exact rock. You can see it from that house. That house looks exactly like the, you know, the one that appeared in the
America's Most Wanted.
No, well, no, but the other documentary, Who Took Johnny?
Oh, Who Took Johnny? I was the co-producer on that one.
Oh, you were?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So you've been to that place.
I'm the guy, I haven't been there, but I'm the guy that found the place. And,
oh, yeah. You are in the documentary. I completely forgot about that.
And I'm the guy who found it and actually found out who owned it when they were stashing kids there. And
are you saying it's my, is it the Aquino?
No, it was not Aquino. Noreen Gosh says it's Aquino in her book, but it was not Aquino. The guy's name was Charles Couch.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I looked him up. Yeah.
And he had, the first time he got busted molesting kids was in 1963. And he molested his son. He molested his wife's brother. I mean, he molested all these kids.
Okay, I never looked into the fact that he was. It's just because I was going down the rabbit hole of Aquino, because of Noreen's book, and so I remember seeing that he was a past owner of the house, but never looked into his past criminal background.
So he molested all these kids in New Mexico. He's actually still alive in New Mexico. I talked to his wife and recorded it. It's on my website. He's an inveterate pedophile. But here's the thing about that. His record, his criminal record has nothing about that in New Mexico. And then he became a prison guard in Colorado when he owned that house. And you cannot be a prison guard if you're a felon. So obviously those felonies had been wiped, but then he fled Colorado as a fugitive. And I could never, ever get to the bottom of why he fled Colorado, because he doesn't have a criminal record in Colorado either.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Was he ever charged and then it was wiped?
Well, he was charged in 1963 for sure. I mean, it was in the newspaper, and but it got wiped and nothing. There was some kind of dispensation with whatever he'd done in Colorado. So I think that
where's he at? New Mexico. I'm only about 30 miles from the New Mexico border. Maybe I can find him.
He's fairly close to Santa Fe.
And okay. That's about 3.5 hours for me.
You should listen to that interview of mine, of his wife. It's a very telling interview.
Okay, I will.
She gets into stuff that that hadn't previously been known about the dude. But that's what kind of amazes me. You had America's Most Wanted put all that money into it, and then I found him. They couldn't find him. I mean America's Most Wanted did some good stuff with the Johnny Gosch story, but and I think that Paul has said a lot of wild stuff, but America's Most Wanted really showed that he was telling the truth about the Johnny Gosch abduction. And he said that there was a chamber underneath the house where the kids were kept. And there was, in fact, a chamber underneath the house where the kids were kept. So,
and writing on the wall and stuff.
Yeah.
With their names and everything. Yeah. I mean, I think that maybe America's Most Wanted did a good job, but they're not probably as dogged as you are, or like obsessed with, they got other shit going on.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, to pull off something like the Franklin scandal, you got to get obsessed with it. Yeah. And everything has got to go in the back seat.
Mm-hmm.
I had a pretty good gig though, as a science reporter. I would cover science conferences. I kind of stopped writing for magazines and I just cover science conferences because I worked for this news service and they pay me pretty well. And then I'd get some cash together, and then because I would go out on the road. I mean, the longest time was like 2 or 3 months. I mean, I spent away from my apartment going. I just went around the country. I had a list of all these Boys Town victims, mm-hmm. and that were scattered around the country. And so I drove around the country looking for these kids.
I do think that's fascinating that. I can't remember his name exactly, but the one that I think he was on meth, and originally basically wanted to fight you when you showed up at his door, but then
that was Rue
crying.
That was
Rue, that's his name.
So it was interesting. I had been looking for Rue for 2 or 3 years, and Rue wasn't the kind of guy that used his social security card. And Rue wasn't the kind of guy that had an electric bill. So finally, there were a couple of people. There were three people I just couldn't find. And I'm really good at finding people, but there were three that I just couldn't find. I hired a private detective, and she had access to the Department of Motor Vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to find Rue, and I called him up, and he said, "Are you a cop?" And I said, "No, I'm not a cop." And he goes, "Are you a cop?" And I said, "No, I'm not a cop." And he goes, "You're a cop." And I said, no, I'm not a cop." And he goes, I said, "I'd like to meet with you." And he goes, "If you're a cop, I'm going to snap your neck." And I said, "Okay, that's cool. I'm not a cop." So we met I went to this dingy bar. I mean, this is the kind of bar where people drink until they die. I mean, whether it's the next day or the next month or the next year. I mean, these were serious drinkers. And I ordered a cranberry juice and it didn't taste quite right. I talk about it in the Franklin scandal. I was glad that I brought some antibiotics with me. And so Rue come in with two other people, and then he goes back here. So they take me to this back room, and where there's pool tables, stuff like that. And it's kind of weird because Rue spent 10 years in prison pumping iron. I mean, he was like a human pit bull and not a guy that I wanted to tangle with, to tell you the truth. But it was kind of weird. He grabbed me and thrust me up against a wall, but I just knew it was going to be cool. I mean, I just knew that. I mean, I, of course, you know, when I went back to that room, I saw where the exit was. I mean, if worse came to worse, I was going to have to try to drill Drew and or Rue and then, you know, go through the exit. But I, you know, it was kind of weird. He just grabbed me and his two buddies were with him, but I just knew it was going to be cool. And he said, How'd you find me? How do you know about me? And Gary Caradore had notes about him. So I showed him Gary Caradore's notes and I said, there was this state investigator and that's how I got your name. And then he saw that Gary Caradore had shown that he'd been to other foster care homes where he'd been molested. And then he'd been molested at Boys Town. So he was a mad dog. And I, the last time I thought, I was leaving Nebraska in a couple of days and I thought, I'm going to try Rue one more time, even though I'm, when I jogged his memory on this stuff, he kept on saying, you've opened the wrong door. You've opened the wrong door. And his thing was vodka and shooting crystal meth. And people like that aren't generally rational.
Yeah.
And it was the strangest thing. So, I mean, Rue frightened me. I'm a big guy, but Rue frightened me. And, but I thought, I'm going to give him one last shot. And I drove to his place and he was with some buddies and they were working on a car. And I said, you know, Rue, how you doing? Good to see you. And he goes, yeah, you know, I've been thinking about talking to you and I think I'm going to talk to you. And so I hung out with them as they worked. I was kind of a gopher that day for, you know, various stuff that they needed. And I think I was the only one that actually had driver's license. And and then I interviewed him. And he became that 12-year-old boy that was really, really damaged, that had grown up in a very dysfunctional, negative environment, that had been repeatedly molested as a child. And he just started crying. And that armor that he wore, that rage that protected him, all of that was gone. I mean, it was an amazing metamorphosis right before my very eyes. And I kept in touch with him. I got him into a rehab. And I went back to Nebraska and he was at the rehab. He was doing good. I took him out for dinner and then I've never heard from him again. So a guy that was banging it like he was banging it with his kind of background, there's a high mortality rate with people like that. And so I was just never able to find him again.
Yeah. Oh, poor guy. Yeah, that's also what got me into the Franklin scandal, is like hearing all the stories of the victims that were abused and like kind of how the way their life went.
You've gotten to know Alicia.
Yeah, I actually feel like we've become friends. She actually invited me to a vacation in Jamaica, but I can't afford it this time. But I really like her a lot and care about her a lot and believe every part of her story. We didn't really go into, you know, the abuse, which understandably she doesn't want to talk about. But I couldn't like her and believe her more and hate what happened to her. And, you know, Robert Wadman, that maybe I shouldn't say his name. Is he dead?
He's not dead, but he's a scumbag for sure.
Yeah. So whatever. Try to sue me, Robert.
Alicia,
your victim.
Alicia,
your victim deserves. Go ahead.
Alicia was indicted for saying that she was molested by Robert Wadman and she was molested by Judge Theodore Carlson, and that she witnessed Omaha World Herald publisher Harold Anderson molesting boys that were as young as 8 years old. So
yeah,
that's what Alicia was indicted
for. Yeah. And she was actually subsequently sent to prison, which was completely unfair. Do you believe her? I believe everything she says, but do you believe the basically murder or suspicious deaths of both her brother and Troy Bonner were?
I believe that her brother was murdered, for sure. He was found, he had like multiple lacerations on his wrists. And he ostensibly hung himself, and he had a big gash on his forehead. And he signed his suicide note AJ. And his name was Aaron. And he'd never referred to himself as AJ before. Mm-hmm. So I think that he was beaten really badly. And they said that he had the big gash in his forehead because he hung himself, and then they cut him down, and then they just let him fall. I mean,
so, I don't think that's.
So I definitely believe that that Aaron killed himself. Troy Bonner's brother is a very strange death. He was ostensibly playing Russian roulette. So I found one of the guys that was with him that night, and. Mm-hmm. It was like I was talking to a Manchurian candidate. It was very strange. It was very mechanical. And I was asking him questions, and he was going, no, sir, yes, sir, and things like that. And I said, so you guys were playing Russian roulette? He goes, yes, sir. And I said, well, had you played Russian roulette before? No, sir. And it was very mechanical. But then I asked him, did you know that Troy and his family were involved in Franklin and that Troy was in the news? He goes, no, I wasn't aware of that. Now, that was a lie for sure, because everybody knew. I mean, Troy's, the footage of Troy had been all over the Omaha area. So there's no way that he could be a friend of the family. And he was a friend of the family and not know that Troy was involved in Franklin. So there's no way. He lied to me there, but I couldn't get anything else out of him. I mean, there were a couple of kids there with him that night. Now, Troy's death is pretty bizarre, too. It's kind of strange. Troy died within 2 weeks of me going to Nebraska. Now, I'm not saying that there's a connection, but it was he died a very strange death in a psychiatric.
Within the first time you went to Nebraska?
Yes.
So, I thought he OD'd. Am I wrong on that?
No, he checked himself into like a psychiatric hospital rehab kind of a place. Mm-hmm. And they checked on him the next morning, and he had some kind of internal hemorrhages. He was bleeding. He was dead and bleeding from kind of like sitting up and bleeding from his mouth.
That is a very strange death for a young kid. Regardless of the fact that he probably was using substances, like that's a very strange death.
It's a very strange death, and his mother did not want to talk to me. I've got an affidavit from his mother, and I've got an affidavit from Troy, but his mother thinks that she lost two children to Franklin, and, you know, it's certainly within the realm of reason that she did. So,
yep.
They moved to Texas, and I reached out to them once. It's very hard in situations like this. You know that people have been heavily abused. You want them to talk to you, but then also you don't want to infringe upon any kind of life that they put together.
Yeah, you don't want to reignite trauma. That was with Alicia that. But she's very of sound mind and very clear and was very much like, I want to talk to you, but I don't want to talk about the abuse. And so I was very careful to not, you know, do that, because you don't want to reignite trauma that someone doesn't, you know, like you're not trying to like, yeah, I guess re-traumatize them.
Well, Alicia is such an amazing human being. I mean, to be in solitary for 2 years when you're, I mean, and to take on the Department of Justice, the FBI, CBS, the New York Times, the Omaha World Herald. I mean, it's she's pretty amazing.
She really is. She's incredibly smart, too.
Very, very smart. And it's interesting. We've become really good friends. She didn't talk to me for like 4 years. I met her once in Ed Fogarty's office, like my second time to Nebraska. And then she wouldn't talk to me for 4 years.
Well, in her own time. She's also feisty too, which I like about her. I think she's
Well, then we ended up driving when we became, when she started talking to me and realized that I'm, you know, pretty decent guy. We started, we went on an ATV tour around her sister's place. It was kind of interesting. And I was driving behind her. And by the time I got back to her sister's place, my face was black. and they're, I love the Owens. That family has been through so much. They're really strong in their faith. And I think that that's enabled them to get through what they've gone through.
Yeah. And she speaks extremely highly of you. Like literally, like after we would talk, she would send me a text being like, you need to listen to this thing on Nick Bryant or whatever. And he's so good with this. And like, she loves you very much.
We love each other. She's a good friend of mine. I really love Alicia, and I love her family too.
Yeah.
And they've been very nice to me. I mean, they didn't talk to me for 4 years, but then after that,
sometimes things take time.
Well, I kept going back to Nebraska, and I didn't push at all. But I would talk to people that I knew were in contact with them. And at a certain point, after 4 years, like my 12th trip to Nebraska or something like that, she said that she'd meet me, and we met in a bar, and we talked. And at that point, I'd become pretty savvy. I knew a lot about the Franklin scandal. She didn't. When we first met in her attorney's office, she did not know whether or not I had the medal to go through Franklin and get to the other side, because she knew that it's a very tough go. And they just wanted to make sure that I was that kind of guy that had the medal, and that I was a good guy too. And I think I ultimately proved that to a number of people in Nebraska. I mean, there were people, I'd show up in Nebraska every couple of months, and there were people that were amazed that I was still alive.
What would you say? So it's a twofold question, because I wanted to ask you this earlier when you're talking about, you have a very good way of tracking people down. And if you're willing to share, like, what are your kind of tactics with that? And then what also are your kind of your journalistic tactics with, like you said, you would go back to Nebraska and you would talk to people that knew Alicia. Like, how do you believe that you essentially win people over? And I believe that you do. You get them to trust you, but is it just being yourself?
It's sheer attrition.
Okay.
I wear them down.
War of attrition?
I wear them down. But the thing about it is, I'm not a pushy guy. And Henry Vincent and I also become good friends.
Mm-hmm. And
I couldn't get Henry to talk to me, and I really needed him to talk to me. And I drove down to West Virginia, to Williamson, West Virginia. And I got his direct dial number. And I think that also has thing. I'm very good at getting information on people. I'm pretty skilled at that. And people tell me I should be a private investigator, but I kind of like being a writer, so I'm not going to really make that switch. But anyway, so I got Henry's private number, and I said, Henry, this is Nick Bryant. You know, I was just in the neighborhood. I'd like to talk to you, but you don't have to talk to me.
I'm just in the neighborhood. I drove to Virginia, but I'm just in the neighborhood.
So
I'm just chilling here.
And I said, yeah, I'm in the neighborhood, and you know, I'd like to talk to you. Now, you don't have to talk to me if you don't want to. And if you want to talk, if you could just spare 10 or 15 minutes, that would be wonderful. And the next day, he was a little surly, but he spared me about 10 or 15 minutes. And I just wanted to show him, you know, dude, I'm a good guy. And then I told him a lot about his case, and that most people wouldn't, the nuances of his case, that
he was impressed by that. And I eventually just wore him down. But and he and I have become very close friends. I love Henry too. I mean, I really, there's a bunch of people in Franklin, I mean, that I love. I mean, I really, I've become very close to them. And there's a couple of victims that I really, really care for and love. I mean, well, actually more than that. Some victims are tough to keep, you know, the ones that are on drugs are impossible to keep in touch with. But mm-hmm. I think that compassion is very important. There's a lot of obstreperous journalists that are self-entitled that think, well, I showed up here and, you know, you've got to talk to me. I never took that approach. I always thought if someone's going to talk to me, that's good, but they don't, they're, I'm not entitled for them to talk to me. And I was never pushy. Although I did show up in Williamson, West Virginia, and just tell Henry I'm in the neighborhood. But then I also said, you're under no obligation to talk to me.
Yeah, you're like, I'm on vacation here. It's not a big deal.
It's no big deal.
I'm just here. I'm here with family and friends. But you also happen to live here. So, anywho.
And Henry, I mean, you know, Henry got really burned by the government. Not nearly as burned as Alicia. I mean, but Henry was very burned by, and, you know, all the people that tried to do the right thing in Franklin were burned really badly. And I just kept that in mind that, you know, these people have been really, really burned, and I'm going to have to prove myself that I'm a good guy and I'm not going to burn anybody. So it just took a while. It's I wore them all down.
But you do come across, and I believe that you are, like, a really good guy. You're lighthearted. You're compassionate. Like, I think that I could see how they would just be like, all right, Nick, fine.
Well, you know, I'm kind of big. I'm a big lumbering, 6'4", and I'm from the Midwest. And I think that they might have just said, well, you know, this guy's kind of big and slow. We're eventually going to talk to him.
You have actually the same body type as my husband. He's 6'4" and thin like you.
Oh yeah, it's
my husband's a lot more loud though, and intense.
But it's funny. I in New York City, when I tell people that I'm from Minneapolis, I studied philosophy in college. They're amazed that someone that philosophy is taught in Minnesota.
It's hilarious.
And I also met a guy who thought that everything west of New Jersey was Ohio. I had to explain to him that there are other states when you get past Ohio before you get to California.
Yeah, so he's from Indianapolis and couldn't rep it harder. I mean, it's his favorite. Like, I'm from Oregon, but I don't care to tell everyone how cool I think that Oregon is. But he's just like, Indiana all the way for the rest of his life. I'm like, all right.
I love Minnesota, but it's very difficult in January. You've got your permafrost 6 months out of every year. So I want to thank you for hanging in there with us. We had some major technical problems today.
We did. I don't know if it's my end or your end, but who cares? We had a good time.
I really enjoyed talking to you. It was great, Rachel. Thank you so much.